Well, good evening, everyone. And I did come down here this evening prepared to give two different talks. But I thought that, then I thought about it a little bit more and I thought maybe it's would be better, feels better to me, for me not to talk so much, but to actually hear what your concerns are, maybe take questions rather than hear what's on your mind and, you know, what you'd like to ask about, and I'll try to respond the best I can. So,
Maybe you can say something about what happened in Virginia today.
I don't know so much about what happened there. I didn't have a chance to look at much news. I saw the headlines and the bare outline of it. But there's a lot to be said about it, I imagine. And and perhaps it's not really to the point for me to talk about it, as if it's something external from you, but rather for you to really have some chance to be with your own feelings and your own reactions to it and give that space. I mean, I could say something, but if you'd like me to, but that's, and it's kind of that, cause with something of that magnitude, sometimes it's having a chance to respectfully make space for our own feelings that are, it's really the most useful thing. I don't know what you would like me to do, or what you'd like to do.
I think coming here and being in with Sangha and doing some loving kindness this evening was what I wanted to do.
One of my thoughts in thinking about what happened there in Virginia in these classrooms is that, you know, people, there's many different ways people can react to something like that. And some of the reactions people have are not so useful. And they could kind of make us victims, in a sense. It kind of can drain us and paralyze us. And one of the ways which is often, one way which often can lead to that point of kind of being paralyzing or deadening for us is to spend too much time blaming or looking externally. I mean, something like that is so far away. I mean, we wouldn't understand it. And but one of the ways I think, which is maybe there's a variety of healthy responses. Loving kindness is one. But I think a very key Buddhist response, one form of Buddhist response, is to reflect on these kinds of things that they happen. And we can't expect them not to happen. It'd be nice if they didn't happen, but they've been happening down through the ages. You can't hear?
No, I'm hearing okay, but I have no idea what happened in Virginia. What am I supposed to do about that? I've never heard of it before.
Oh, I see. For those of you who weren't on the news today.
Context.
Oh, context. Okay. There was a gunman who went into the Virginia Tech University and shot 32 people.
And himself.
And it started off as, there was a whole drama there. It took several hours to unfold. And some of you who, you want to be careful how you read the news or learn about it, because there's all these stories. I got a little hint. And when I came home, my wife told me one of the stories that she'd heard on the radio. And I felt kind of sick after hearing one story that she told me. And so you might want to be careful. You don't want to be a voyeur. You don't want to just read it for the sensational value. And there's value in facing the tragedies and taking it in, being witness. There's a very wise and important way that people bear witness. And to what happens in the world, to ignore what happens in the world, is sometimes another form of violence. If you don't ignore it too actively, you know, or out of aversion or out of fear. But there's a way of bearing witness, which is very important. And in Buddhism, we have the, in Mahayana Buddhism, you have the image of Avalokiteshvara. And Avalokiteshvara is the one who sees the suffering of the world, or the one who hears the suffering of the world. So, but to bear witness, you want to be careful, perhaps, you know, if you, tomorrow morning or this evening or something with the news, that you do it wisely. It may be something you want to do, feel like it's useful to read what happened and get some of the stories. You might want to prepare yourself and meditate first and kind of tap into your wisdom and your motivation and how you want to, you know, take this in and what you want to do with it. The so one of the Buddhist responses, I believe, to such a thing is because these things do happen in the world, they're not... And the magnitude of it and the scale of it has never happened in America in this way before, so in that sense it's unique. But tragedies like this happen all the time, unfortunately. And one of the approaches in Buddhism is realizing that is to train ourselves. Are we prepared ourselves? How are we prepared? And not to kind of keep an arm's distance or pretend it can never happen, or but are we prepared? And hopefully it'll never happen. Something like that will never happen to us. But sooner or later, something will happen to you. Sooner or later, you'll face your death. Probably. I always feel, for myself, I feel, you know, that it's time for me to die. I would like to go slow. I would like to be conscious of the process, whatever way. So I know some people would like to go quickly and not be aware. I think maybe Woody Allen said, you know, I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there. But but in small scales and big scales, something's happening. So are we prepared? This is the interesting question. Or can we be inspired, in a sense, or motivated by such an event to reflect, you know, are we prepared? The one story I heard from my wife had to do with some people who offered some resistance to the gunmen. And so it's a noble thing to resist, and a wonderful thing. But does it take preparation? The story that I like to tell, maybe I've told it too many times here, but many, many years ago in Palo Alto, when I was teaching there, a woman came up to me and said, you know, I often go into Palo Alto late at night, in the evening or something, when it's dark, and I park my car, I'm alone, I feel afraid in Palo Alto, and feels not safe for me. And what do you think about, what do you think if I get a gun? And I don't really want to be in the business of advising people for or against getting guns. Though, I'd prefer to say don't. But I don't want to be in the business. But what I said to her was, I think it's kind of unfortunate that people in America, or many people, mainly in America, will all too quickly go to the guns, all too quickly go to being angry, or all too quickly go to violence. And some of that's because they haven't prepared themselves. And, you know, you could do that, but you could also, it might be more helpful for the society and for yourself in the long run. You might do some kind of... you know, what are they called? There's various programs, you know, anti-mugging programs. What?
Self-defense.
Self-defense. Yeah, there's some nice, cute. One of them is, there's some cute titles for them. The better mug. Anyway, and you know, you might prepare yourself. There's also trainings in non-violent action that people can do. There's ways you can prepare yourself so that when something comes along, perhaps you're in a little bit better position, so you don't need to use a gun. And that's what I told her. You know, I don't know no idea what happened. And so to be prepared, and to kind of have this attitude that life is such a way that it's not right for me to have to prepare myself. I shouldn't have to do any work. You know, I just life is what you know. I deserve the best. I deserve safety, I deserve everything just to be just right. And anything comes along that ruffles that, they're bad. That's a bad thing. It's wrong. They're, you know, look externally. And today I talked to a woman who said that she just realized that now as her mother is getting a little bit senile, that her mother has spent her life blaming other people. Incapable, absolutely incapable of taking any responsibility for herself. And that this blaming someone else always shaped the character, the disposition, the personality of the daughter. And the daughter is now, you know, middle age. And she's just kind of realizing the degree to which her mother's inability to take responsibility for her own actions, always putting it on other people, it caused the daughter to always feel that she was wrong. And it kind of became her character. Something's always wrong with me because my mother's always telling me that I'm at fault. So to prepare oneself. So I think Buddhism is one of the ways to look at Buddhism is its preparation. And preparation to die, preparation to meet the world in a wise way, an effective way, the way that perhaps you want to meet the world in a situation that's challenging. For me, when one of my first interests in Buddhism, interest in doing Buddhist practice, was, I was in college. I was in college, mm-hmm. College dorms and stuff, during the Vietnam War, and some of the students on campuses were getting shot then too. But then there were people were being shot from the protests, anti-Vietnam War protests. And I was a pacifist. Still feel myself as a pacifist. But so I was often the one who had to defend the pacifist stand in the college dormitory debates that we had, late night debates. And in those conversations, it became obvious to me, in my heart, really, that I wanted to live by these ideals. But that doesn't mean I was going to be passive. It meant that in order to follow through on them, I had to be willing to put myself in situations of nonviolent disobedience or nonviolent protest, put myself in situations where maybe my life was a danger. And however, I felt afraid to do that. And the tension or the contrast between my ideal of what I wanted to be able to do and what I could do because of what I couldn't do because of my fear motivated me. And as I looked around, what can help me somehow deal with this fear so that I wouldn't have this fear, so I can live by this ideal? And I have no idea why, but somehow my mind found Buddhism. And I thought, oh, Buddhist practice, that can do it. And that was my first interest in Buddhism for myself. And but it wasn't enough to start practicing. I was, maybe still too intellectual. But it got my interest, it got my attention. So to prepare, and so whether you know it or not, Buddhist practice is preparation, because we sit and we look at ourselves and we get to see our reactions and responses. If you practice sitting still like we do in meditation, then we're practicing not giving in to the whims and reactions, habitual responses of our mind, and that's a powerful training. And then you'll find yourself sometime coming in a situation where, in real life, outside of meditation, where you have that ability not to give into a reaction, a response. Someone once said, it can take years to develop a really good friend, and it can take a sentence to ruin it, the friendship. It's just some kind of reaction, some kind of response. There was automatic pilot. He says something. And so in many situations, so have the ability to stay calm, collected in times of crisis. The ability, and this is even more challenging, the ability to evoke, arouse, come from places of kindness or love or loving kindness, even when someone's angry with you, even if someone is being abusive to you. Of course, you should stop them. The story that's told in our circles, kind of in the Vipassana world is was a woman who was practicing in India many years ago now. And I guess someone tried to grab her bag or do something in the streets of India. And I don't know, she got free or got away, but then she went, I don't know what happened there, but she went to her teacher, her Vipassana teacher in India, Manindra, and said, explain what had happened. He said, what should I have done? This guy was going to mug me or something. And he said, with all the loving kindness you can muster, hit him over the head with your umbrella. I think it's a beautiful story. When I was living at the San Francisco Zen Center, the San Francisco Zen Center is in a place in San Francisco that used to be much more than it is now, quite crime-laden, and was not uncommon to get mugged at knife point or gun point, it was not necessarily not a particularly safe neighborhood. And there was a man there. He was a Zen priest, and he was one day he was held up, I think at knife point. The guy said, "I want your money" or something. And there's great stories from Zen Center of the old days when people used to get mugged. Of back in the days. Great examples of people who stayed calm, people who stayed calm in those situations and somehow found their way out of it. And examples of people who didn't stay calm. In one example, the person didn't stay calm, and the one who didn't stay calm, he ended up in jail. And it was not a pretty story. You can read about it in the Chronicle if you go back enough years. Very, very embarrassing for the person who ended up in jail. But the story I was thinking about now is this guy was being held up at knife point, and so he engaged him in a very nice way and said, sure, but I need a little bit of money for the bus to go home. And so they were having a conversation. And then another priest walked by on the street, because go to the same meeting that they were both going to, and walked right by and walked into the building. And so then the mugging was over, and so the muggee went into the building, into the meeting, and sat down next to the person who had passed them in the street, and said, "Oh, you remember seeing me on the street there? Oh yeah, you seemed like you were talking to someone." And then he explained, well, actually I was being mugged, and we were just talking about it and working it out. And there was another example of, when I was living up there, I was on the street. Is it okay to tell stories like this? Is it appropriate? I was going to let you talk. I was living up there, and I was out in the street. And this car comes screeching down Haight Street and Haight and Laguna. And it comes screeching down, kind of swerving back and forth, and screeches into the intersection, stops in the middle of the intersection. And it stops. And out of the car tumbles this woman. And kind of tumbles into the middle of the intersection. And then pour out these two guys. It looked like they should be really big football players. Really big. And they were interested in getting her back in the car. But she was not interested in going. She was trying to get away from them. And it was this big scene. So I went up there. It seemed like I could not do anything. So I went up there and stood between these big guys and these women. And I wasn't particularly calm. I was just kind of wasn't particularly wise, but I had to do something. So I was standing there, And they said, you know, get out of our way. You know, and they would take a step towards me, and I'd take a step back. And basically, it was this dance. They were telling me something, and I don't know if I said anything at all. But, they would take a step forward, I'd take a step back, and she was behind me. And then this other guy walked up, and he said to the big football players, he said, "Oh, if you were in her position, you probably would hope someone would come and check in on you, check up on you, or maybe he can help you out." And that just saying that turned the whole thing. And they relaxed, the woman relaxed, everyone relaxed, and the whole thing was settled that easily. So, I don't know if the guy was calm who said that, but I wasn't. You know, I was just... I was just trying to help, but didn't know what to do. Kind of frozen, trying to help. And anyway, so I'm sorry to just go on. So please, send someone else. Anything. Yes?
When you said that if we were prepared for bad things to happen, that I was trying to finish that thought, that we would have different choices, we'd respond differently than in anger or violence. Was that the... And I'm wondering if you could expand on that. What do you mean by prepared? And just being able to... I mean, if I can meditate on the cushion, that's one thing. But if something bad happens in my face, how... I mean, I can make guesses, but I'd like to hear more. What would you think of the preparation that would make me more able to respond wisely?
Uh-huh. One of the beautiful things about meditation practice or mindfulness practice, which is not limited to the cushion, or loving kindness practice, any kind of spiritual training probably, is that develops and trains many different capacities, human capacities that we have. So to say it just does one thing is to kind of be too simplistic. But to give you a few things, one thing that meditation can do is help you stay calm. And staying calm is often quite helpful. You can often see much more clearly. You can let more creativity rise inside of you when you're calm. When you're anxious, not a lot of creativity. And there's a, you know, you never know what kind of creative things will come up. Another guy was being mugged at Zen Center, outside of Zen Center. I don't know if it was a man or a woman, but it was, you know, it's kind of these kids came up to mug him or her. And out of her mouth, or his mouth, came, "Your mama would be ashamed of you." and that ended it. And then there was someone who went off from a Vipassana retreat, went off into the wilderness from the retreat, far away from the retreat once, and was sunbathing, I think, topless someplace. You know, thought she was out in nowhere land by herself. And some survivalist out there showed up with his gun and his knife and thought this was, you know, a gift from heaven. and asked her to take off her pants. And she didn't know where I came from, but she said, "You're no Christian. You're no Christian. Give me that gun." He did, and she threw the gun away and ran like the hell out of there. So I don't know if those all the people are necessarily calm, but being calm, you know, can increase their creativity, and sometimes the intuition can operate sometimes, where you kind of get a sense of things that might... also, if you're calm, you might see yourself better, and you might not make a mistake. Sometimes mistakes are made when we act reactively, very quickly, and get nervous, get upset. When you're calm, you're less likely to get nervous, upset, angry, afraid. Also, if you're calm, or if you have a capacity for mindfulness, you're much more likely to notice what your reactions are. And if you notice, if you have very clear awareness of your reactions, you have more choice about whether to act on them or not, and or to speak on them or not. So, so there's all kinds of things you might do that are not useful to do, and get even more into more trouble. The other thing that it might do, I think, calm, mindfulness, attention does, is as you get to know yourself better, You also get to be able to some degree, be able to understand other people better. You get to be able to understand some depth in them. You understand some depth in yourself. Understand the depth of your suffering, for example. It's easier to see and understand the depth of other people's suffering. And sometimes one of the most useful things you can do in meeting someone is to actually understand what's behind them, what's going on more deeply within them. So another Zen Center priest story of he pulled into a parking space that someone else was waiting for, so, which is not good, right? You know, they've been waiting and someone pulled out and he didn't see the person waiting. He just thought, oh, it's free, pulled in. And the person waiting went ballistic. He got out of the car and was yelling and really upset, road rage. And the priest looked at him and said after a while, you can't just do this kind of, you have to kind of intuitively know this is the right thing. Not that it's a cliche or something, you know, to know this. He said to him, you're having a hard day, aren't you? And the guy said, yeah. And he's, you know, that, and then the whole thing, you know, what, I don't know, diffused and was taken care of. So he had the capacity to see and understand something in the other person. And so to have the person have an ability to listen and see and understand, and perhaps also have the ability to have compassion for someone else. Someone came on retreat once many years ago and told me that she was, it's actually a similar story as of today. A gunman came in and took her and a whole bunch of other people in the class hostage. And so they were barricaded in there, hostages with this gunman. And the pivotal moment for her in that hostage situation was looking into the hostage taker's eyes and seeing deeply into him, his humanity, his suffering, his situation there. And I don't know if that changed the situation, but I think that the gunman was killed in the end. But some of that was a transformative moment in her life, was to actually be able to look him in the eye and kind of have that connection. Another thing that can be useful to do with Buddhist training is Buddhist training will teach you how to let go. And letting go is a really important capacity. If you don't know how to let go, you increase your chances of suffering exponentially. And so life sooner or later will ask you to let go. And if you have the ability to let go, then you won't suffer as much. If you don't have the ability to let go, then you'll suffer a lot. And so, for example, some of you are no longer spring chickens, as they say. Some of us. I had surgery two weeks ago, less than 2 weeks ago now, and it felt like a rite of passage to me. I'm 52, and I said, oh, you know, it really felt like I was, you know, really a turning into that wonderful period of decline. and we could kick and scream and say this shouldn't be happening, and or it's a personal failure to get old. And that's a possibility, right? And there was embarrassment. And so what I've noticed myself as I'm aging now, that there are capacities that I used to have I don't have anymore. I don't have as well. And I don't heal as quickly. I don't have the same stamina I used to have. And things are happening to happen to me that are sometimes attributed to getting older. And so I could suffer or I can let go. And currently my attitude, primary attitude, I hope it's realistic, I hope I'm not fooling myself, is that every opportunity to let go in a healthy, you know, can bring joy. Doesn't have to be a disappointment, doesn't have to be a source of grief. There's something in letting go that's quite profound. Of course, it's unfortunate to lose certain abilities and all kinds of things, but there's something very profound in being able to let go. And I've known many people who've had some kind of major health crisis that shouldn't have happened. Of course it shouldn't have happened. And it's quite tragic. It changes their life radically, their whole identity radically. And then after some years, they say, that was the most important thing that happened in my life. I was able to let go. I was able to let go of a certain identity that I was holding on to. I felt like I had to be. And I was able to free myself from... I didn't realize it was a problem. I didn't realize there was a possibility of freedom the other side of that until it was basically taken away from me and I struggled until I became free. So we cultivate the ability to let go. And letting go is very important in times of crisis. Someone had bought a house recently, right? Can you let go of it if there's an earthquake? You know, we live in an earthquake country. Who knows what's going to happen, right? And you can hang on for dear life. You can hang on long after the house is gone. Right? And so to let go is helpful. Another thing that helps with spiritual training, I believe, is cultivation of compassion for oneself, care for oneself, kindness towards oneself. And that's very helpful. It's helpful to understand how our mind works more than just reactive minds. It's helpful to begin understanding and unraveling some of the deeper mindsets, some of the deeper beliefs that operate for us. So for the example I gave earlier of the woman who, the mother who spent her lifetime blaming other people for everything, that's a mindset. Or her daughter spent her lifetime thinking she was always wrong. There's all these very, very deep-seated beliefs we have that will come into play in times of crisis. And one of the ways to prepare ourselves is to begin doing whatever worked, a variety of ways to do this, but certainly through meditation practice, your mind can get quite still, quite mindful, and begin seeing, understanding some of the ways you talk to yourself, some of the things you believe that are not necessarily so accessible when you go around kind of just ordinary, you know, mental chatter, kind of doing your life ordinary. You need to kind of be still or quiet. Going on retreats is a powerful way of doing this. Even if you think you have no meditative ability at all, if you go in a silent retreat, chances are pretty well that you will know yourself better, know parts of yourself that you didn't know before by the end of the retreat. Because you start the ability to be on retreat and begin to look and see and increases dramatically there. So begin understanding ourselves and understand what we really need. In the current inquiring mind, which we'll have out probably here for free soon. There's several articles about renunciation, I think, but there's one by Ajahn Amaro, a Buddhist monk. And what his crew, the monastic Buddhist monastic crew, like to emphasize is that something like this. People think that the monks and nuns in Buddhism are renunciants because they have to give up. They give up a lot. You know, conventionally things. They give up, in that tradition, they give up having money. They give up eating food after 12 o'clock noon. They give up having a variety, a varied wardrobe. You put on the same clothes every day. And they give up their hair. Though nowadays, sometimes it's kind of cool to be shaved. and they give up sex. And all kinds of things they have to give up. And so, you know, from one point of view, boy, these are really renunciants. They've given up a lot. I've heard one of these, or read one of these monastics say, oh, they think that the real renunciants are not them. The real renunciants are the lay people who hang on to all those things because they're the ones who are giving up this very profound happiness that is possible when you let go deeply. And so for Ajahn Amaro, his renunciation is not a source of deprivation. It's an opportunity for feeling really free and happy. And he feels he's not giving up anything. He's gaining in the process. It looks like renunciation, but for him, it's a gain. And maybe then we can say, oh, those are so selfish, those monks. those monks and nuns, you know, they're so selfish. You know, they give up having sex with all the rest of us so they can be happy. Don't they know what they're giving up? They do. How much drama and crisis. So I don't know. So I go on and on, but you're probably boring some of you now. Someone else? Yes, please.
I've never had any It's fear for myself of things like that, but after becoming a mother, events like today, it strikes panic in me.
Sure, makes sense.
And I don't know if the advice is the same, but the fear is very profound.
Yes, so I mean the first response, I think, you know, in our circles would be to make space for that panic, to be respectful of it, to feel it, make room for it, not to try to hold it at arm's distance, not to try to argue it away, not to try to quickly kind of sort of solve it, but to really give it, treat it as something that really deserves attention and respect. And then, if you do that, and you bring careful mindfulness to it, and you begin practicing some ability to get calm around it, then with time you might be able to start teasing apart some of the different strands that make it up. And the chances are that there are different strands. And some of the fear is connected to beliefs that maybe are not so well warranted. Some of the things you're holding on to or attached to, some things you're afraid of losing, maybe if you bring a wise eye to that, you'd be willing to let go of. And some of the strands belong to perhaps the innate bonding and natural care that a parent has for a child. And of course you'd be afraid for your child. You know, I wouldn't want to take that away from you. And, you know, it's part of the love, part of the responsibility of a parent to have that kind of concern. I don't understand it myself, what happens between parents and their kids. And I say that because I'm a parent. And I don't understand, but some of the reactions I have when I'm being a parent, I don't see as being that, you know, cause some suffering like fears like that. Sometimes it's overdone, and sometimes it's quite appropriate. It's part of being a parent. If you have kids, you're going to have some strong feelings from time to time. You know, things will happen. And, but the practice hopefully will tease apart the strands which are unnecessary, the strands that are. And the practice maybe will help you to hold your fear, your worry, your whatever feelings in a wise way, in a compassionate way, and in a way that doesn't limit you. It doesn't prevent you from living in a wise way. It might always be there. The first inkling I had of something operating here that wasn't born from my clinging, my neurosis, my certain kind of bonding was when I was in Palo Alto talking to someone. I was walking my little son. I don't know how old he was. He was walking, maybe a year and a half, or pretty young, very young. And we were walking down the street together. And so I ran into someone I knew, and we were talking a little bit. And I had my back to the street. And suddenly I was aware that my son was not next to me. And the immediate thing I did, I mean, it was like, you know, like you touch a hot stove and you move your hand, you know, that kind of reflex. The immediate thing I did was I swiveled around to make sure he wasn't in the street. I thought, oh, that's something. That's something very deep going on in here. This bonding, the connection, the sense of, you know. And so it's a kind of mystery what that is. And you're in it. So treat yourself well and kindly. Last one, maybe.
I've read a couple of news stories about how...
I would like to interrupt you.
Oh, sure.
And then you get a chance. But I want to say one more thing about fear and children and reaction to children. You know, there's many different perspectives to understand what we're doing and with children and our relationship to them. But I think it's really important. One of the most important things a parent can do for you, especially a very young child, is to work on themselves. And there's a very poignant story like of this, of a Vipassana student, many year student, who was diagnosed with cancer. She was going to die of cancer. And so she had a 9-year-old son. And which was tragic, right? She was going to, you know, she tried to stay. She did everything she could to try to stay alive. At some point, it became clear she wasn't going to live anymore. And she was afraid for her, mostly afraid for her child. And angry and all these things. And I told her that probably one of the best gifts, since she was going to die relatively soon, that probably one of the best gifts, most beautiful things she can do for her child, was not to die afraid and not to die angry, but to die at peace with dying. That would, you know, the lesson or what would go in, like, you know, mother's milk goes in or something, what would go into the child would be, you know, be so different, be so beneficial if she could do that work and come to that place. You know, she had to accept the fact she was dying, so try to do the work and see if you can come to a different place for the sake of your child. And she did. It was a quite beautiful death. I wasn't there, but apparently quite beautiful death. And after the death, the daughter went someplace in the garden or something and found a flower and came and put the flower on their mother's chest. So it's really important to do the work. Yeah. For our children's sake.
I guess when something happens like happened today, the thing that immediately goes through people's minds is it could happen again real soon and a lot closer to home.
Yeah.
Or it could happen often if there's this. If the trend is toward a breakdown in society in some way. And of course, it does happen in Iraq and other places, you know, all the time. And I've read a couple of news stories saying that there's a lot of mental illness in Iraq. The psychiatric or mental health hospitals in Iraq are in the countries where Iraqi refugees are going to are just overwhelmed, and so people are going crazy.
People are crazy here. I can't tell you how many times I've been on retreat teaching retreats, and people have come into retreats to talk with me about, you know, what they need to work through or work with, and they're dealing with war trauma. You know, it's happened. You know, all these things that happen in the world don't happen very far away, and it became clear to me as a teacher, you know, over and over and over again. It hasn't happened so much anymore now; it's a bit further away. But when I started teaching early '90s, there was still a lot of people dealing with World War II. You know, we have people here in our community here for whom World War II is still a formative experience. The trauma of that they still carry. And I've known people, and then remember the Rodney King riots. For me, that was also kind of far away. Until someone came to retreat and said, "Oh, she's dealing with the fact her father was one of the people who was basically turned into kind of a vegetable during those riots, and so there are all the issues that have to do with that." So these things are not so far away. Iraq's not so far away. Nothing's far away. And you said, you know, society is disintegrating. Perhaps it is, but it's always going up and down. And I think part of the Buddhist perspective is you kind of, you know, it's not like a surprise. It's, you know, it's not like we should be, you know, surprised. You know, I think people who live with their, you know, ignoring history and ignoring. We'll often think that you know, this is a surprise, but it shouldn't make us ineffectual. It shouldn't make us victims of it. It shouldn't make us passive to it. And I can, you know, honestly say, you know, passionately say, that my choice to be a Buddhist teacher, and all the work that I do, is very much one attempt. To try to respond to the magnitude of suffering in this world, it became not even a choice. It became almost like who I am or who I'm not. You know, it's just kind of what's flowing through me. that this life of mine was going to be a response. That's what it's going to be about, was responding to the suffering. And you might think, oh, you know, well, teaching someone mindfulness here Wednesday evening is not, you know, that's nice, but, you know, maybe you can make them better. I don't know. But, and when I read, you know, what happens in Virginia, or read about what happens in Iraq, it really, it motivates me. I don't feel unmotivated by that. I don't feel exactly kind of shut down by that. It actually gives me a kind of motivation to try harder. So when I come here Wednesday evening to try to do the intro class, I'll try to do a better job because of it. Because it's, see, you know, in my small way, in my small corner of the universe, can I make a difference? Can I try to touch the suffering of the world? Can I kind of meet the world? Because I have a very deep belief, understanding, that the Buddhist practice, certainly other spiritual practices as well, are practices which are, in its essence, or in its heart, or has potential of really touching the deepest places of suffering, of holding, of fear, of anger, the kind of the deepest places that not only suffer, but also perpetuate the cycles of suffering in this world. And it's essential that those people who know about being able to touch those places and heal those places speak up and try to offer that kind of work. And so for me, very much what we do here, I feel is maybe not, you know, I don't know how effective we are in the big picture, but it's, you know, that's, and it's behind my mind very much what we're doing here. So I interrupted you. I went on and on and on. I apologize.
Well, I'll finish quickly. So, you know, every now and then something happens that comes up and makes me very fearful, and so boy, there's a lot of suffering in me when that happens, this conversation is just reminding me that if something happens here that, like was happening in Iraq or happened in Virginia, it's our job not to, as Buddhists, not to go insane, and so. It takes some effort, but I remember the techniques eventually. Mm-hmm. There are ways.
It's a great gift we give to the world, those of us, any of us, anybody in the world, who's able to stay calm, keep their heart open and loving, and try to tap into their wisdom, and try to respond to the world in generous, nonviolent ways, kind ways. It's a phenomenal gift we give. And I hope that that those of you who came here tonight, that you will perhaps reflect a little bit, that we've had a room full of, I don't know how many people here, 70, 80 people, who have been practicing a practice which is time-honored and respected down through the ages as something that has the potential of kind of working in the deepest, most beautiful places in the heart, something which is recognized in Buddhism as one of the great gifts that is possible to experience in human life, that it's really something to be in a gathering like this. And part of the classic reflection in Buddhism is to reflect about the goodness, reflect about the benefits, the merit that this kind of activity does. And then very consciously think about how that can be shared with others. Very consciously, don't try to keep all that benefit to yourself. But somehow or other, reflect or have the intention, the wish, that whatever comes here, whatever benefits we have here, that it's shared with other people. And so as we leave today, may whatever benefits, merit that comes from our time together here, may it be sent out to all the people who have been directly touched by the tragedies in Virginia, so that the very best qualities in them might come out and that their hearts might feel the world's compassion and care for them. Thank you.